I'll call the meeting to order, and first item is adoption of the minutes. Representative Erickson moves the minutes.
Just a minute, I have.
Mr. Chair, I will move approval of the minutes.
Representative Erickson moves the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? None. So the minutes are approved. Now we're going to have presentations from the Department of Human Services. And first is Christine Bronson, Deputy Commissioner, and Tim Wilkin, Assistant Commissioner, to talk about the agency-wide activities. And welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Christine Bronson. I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. And I'm here to introduce you today to some of the operations area of DHS and a couple of the budget pages in the governor's budget. Mr. Chair, I'm happy to go through the very preliminary pages in the budget book that have an overview of the agency, if you would like me to.
Yeah.
Okay. The first page of your book is the formal transmittal letter. This is the first white page. The first white page in your book, which is the formal transmittal letter from the commissioner to you presenting the human services portions of the governor's budget. You'll notice that the letter outlines the high-level budget figures for the agency, that the governor's budget proposes to spend $9.3 billion in general fund dollars and $12.9 billion in other funds in the upcoming biennium. This is a 14.4% increase over 06-07 spending, and the rest of the book outlines the detail behind that spending. Page 4 of your materials gives the agency's profile, which is the broadest overview of the work performed at the Department of Human Services. It begins with the agency's mission statement to help people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. The rest of the narrative on that page describes Minnesota's three major health care programs, MinnesotaCare, Medicaid, and GAMC. It outlines the major populations that are served through DHS programs, and it describes the operations components of the agency, including fiscal relationships with 87 counties, 43,000 healthcare providers, and 26,000 licensed entities, as well as the operations of five major computer systems that support management of programs and business partners. Page 6 gives the fiscal agency overview outlining the highest level of three major funds, the General Fund, Healthcare Access Fund, and TANF Fund, and two minor funds, the Lottery Fund and Special Revenue Accounts. The last number on the page shows the agency's total 08-09 all-funds budget as recommended by the governor at $22.2 billion, representing 34% of the state's total all-funds budget. The next four pages, 8, 9, 10, and 11, are a catalog and summary of the governor's recommended change items, and they correspond to the change pages distributed throughout the budget book. Page 12 begins summary of the next layer of detail in the budget materials, the program level.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions. The regarding the co-pays for the health, Minnesota Care, or not Minnesota Care, medical assistance that we collect, how much have you collected and how much does it cost us to actually collect those co-pays that we instituted a couple of years ago?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tao.
Commissioner.
This is not, the collection of those co-pays are done at the provider site. So it is an activity that's done at the doctor's office or the pharmacy. In that respect, there isn't an administrative cost to the collection activity for the department. I could certainly get back to the committee with the cost of that proposal when it was instituted, because there was a decrease in our general fund investment by instituting that policy.
Sure. Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Sid. I just asked an overview question and a conceptual one. Welcome back. I asked Mr. Coleman, and he's actually not high enough on the food chain. I thought you were getting higher, so I'm going to ask you the question. Lonely at the top, I know, at least the vice top. But we've talked about the just conceptually about some of the budgets that you propose, and I know it's a very difficult, very expensive budget that we have, and I understand the choices and trade-offs. Well, like with the nursing home monies, for instance, the 2-2 or the 1.5 with the bonuses and all, it's pretty well agreed that that's not enough to help them get health care for their workers and to do the job. And I asked Mr. Coleman, I said, then are you relaxing some of the duties of the nursing homes or some of their, is there some way? And he said that they rely on alternate streams of income, be it Medicare, some of the transitional beds, and maybe they might have a bingo operation that would raise some money and some of the bake sales, apparently. I'm being facetious now, but it seems to me that since we all understand that that's a harder amount of money to do the job on, that the department should be offering some advice about how they would actually live on that and in their budget and say, we're proposing changing some rules and making some flexibilities, and I don't see that. And so I thought I'd ask you that. I hope you take it as a kind question. I'm sincere in my asking it.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, Assistant Commissioner Coleman's response is the true one. In any budget that's put together by the governor or a legislative body, it's a matter of prioritizing a lot of significant needs, especially in the Health and Human Services budget, against each other. The nursing home industry is an industry that has received modest increases over the last several years, even in a high deficit climate. Some of those increases have been higher than other providers that are serving similarly vulnerable populations. The governor's proposal for a 2-2 increase is what is affordable in the balance of priorities in his budget.
And Mr.
Representative Abler.
And, you know, I respect you a lot, but it just must be frustrating for the department and for the governor as well to have to propose a budget. And I think they will be in the same position trying to find enough resources and given the constraints, but it's just, if we look at the education budget, I have a similar talk to the department about that. I just met my district last night, and it's a very challenging budget to even recognize inflation is not 1.5 and 2. And so I guess we're in this together. But I would hope at some point that the advocates and the department can find a way to design a model that works given the money that's available. And the same thing's true in the Medicaid budgets. There's no provider of who's not the UCare bus that serves the dental access people. Short of that kind of group that can actually survive on a rate that we pay our providers. And yet, it's 13% of the book of business statewide. So it's just maybe it's a comment, but I'm trying to find a way to work around that, and I'm trying to be, there's maybe something to be done. So I'm just raising there, since you're kind of there now, so to encourage your people. Thanks.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I'll continue on page 12. Page 12 begins summary of the next layer of detail in the budget materials, the program level. The agency management program is comprised of 4 budget activities: the financial operations activity, legal and regulatory operations, management operations, and technology operations. Together, these 4 operational areas are recommended to be funded at $143 million in the upcoming biennium. The corresponding highest level fiscal information is found on pages 13 and 14. I will take some time here to describe the first of the 4 areas, the financial operations area, and then turn things over to Commissioner Wilkin, who has management responsibility for the other 3. The financial operations area assures the fiscal integrity of Minnesota's human services programs, maintaining processes that adhere to state and federal law. The financial operations staff provide fiscal analysis, reporting, and documentation of financial transactions and program expenditures. It provides guidance, best practices training, and technical assistance to divisions throughout the agency, as well as to counties and other business partners. Financial operations is a critical support function to all program activities managed and overseen by DHS. It ensures strong fiscal management of the agency's $22 billion biennial budget, and reinforces the culture of fiscal prudence, practice, and management amongst DHS staff and the agency's partners. Some of the measures used to track the agency's performance are found on page 16 and 17 and include a 98.6% grade on paying promptly and a 99% grade on handling receipt of payments within 24 hours. The cost of the financial operations activity is $11 million a year. Summary across all three major accounts is found on page 18. As a final review of financial operations activities, I'd like to turn your attention to page 35 in your materials, to the page entitled Revenue and Pass-Through Expense. This standard page was created several years ago as a way to avoid showing what appeared to be double counting of items on individual budget pages when money is received by the state and then passed on to another account or entity. For example, when the state receives the parental payment of child support, the payment is accounted for but immediately passed on to the family. In addition to receiving and documenting more than $4.5 billion a year in revenue, the agency handles about $1 billion as pass-through payments, and this page prevents these in-and-out payments from skewing individual program areas and budget pages. It is a technical solution to what otherwise would be a confusing representation of accounts.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know if this is the right time to talk about or if we'll do it later, but in terms of the funds, there's a major shift of $70 million related to TANF refinancing. And will we at some point get an overview on the TANF fund and how that, the uses of it and that sort of thing? Because this is one of the largest numbers we'll see in terms of shifting of dollars. And it's on page 36. It's also on some of the earlier fund summaries that Ms. Bronson went through. And I don't remember that being overviewed when we talked about the TANF and income maintenance programs.
Commissioner Johnson was in, and he did talk some about TANF, but I don't remember if he dealt with that particular issue. And if he didn't, we can get him back in here to do that.
Okay.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, as a matter of fact, I'm ready to turn to the two budget pages that I will walk through, and one of them is the TANF refinancing page. The first budget page that I'll review with you is found on page 232. It's the last pages of your white materials. It's entitled TANF Refinancing. Many of you know that TANF, which stands for Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, is Minnesota's block grant from the federal government to run our MFIP program and other activities that provide economic support to poor families. All TANF funds must be spent on federally defined purposes, and such expenditures must be documented. In addition, Minnesota is required to continue a maintenance of effort investment, or MOE investment, of $170 million a year of state-only investment in eligible activities for poor families. The TANF fund and TANF MOE investments are tracked separately from the general fund. Throughout the budget process, when you receive budget tracking documents for the general fund, you will separately receive a one-page TANF fund balance and a one-page healthcare access fund balance. This change page, while not making any programmatic changes, is necessary to properly document which Minnesota programs and investments, be they cash grants, child care, or tax credits, are funded out of which of three funds, the general fund, TANF fund, or TANF MOE. The governor's budget recommends that child care, currently funded with general fund TANF MOE dollars, now be funded with TANF dollars, and that the existing working family credit funded with general fund dollars be counted as TANF MOE. The page has the effect of properly documenting the use of all funds for eligible purposes and supports the state's economic assistance programs as they are proposed in the governor's budget.
Commissioners, is this a change from the past in terms of where the child care was paid from?
Mr. Chair, it is. Prior to this, child care was funded out of TANF MOE dollars. So this isn't changing the level of investment. It's changing to what account the expense is pointed.
Okay, well, members, this may be one that leads to some confusion with Representative Slawick's committee. But that's our problem, not the commissioner's.
The second change page I will direct your attention to is page 234, entitled Compensation Adjustment. This page outlines the governor's proposal to provide a 2% per year rate increase to DHS staff. This increase mitigates typical and existing increases in costs, including pension obligations, projected health insurance increases, and costs of steps and progressions that are part of existing bargaining agreements. It also sets the parameters for any increases that might be negotiated in the coming year's labor negotiations. Other committees will review similar budget pages for the respective agencies they oversee. This page also requests a 3.25% per year increase for specialized direct care services performed by specific DHS staff. This increase applies to those staff working at the state's regional treatment centers and for secure programs such as the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, MEDO, and the Mentally Ill and Dangerous Program. It does not include any state-provided direct care services that are run on an enterprise basis, primarily our SOCS programs. You will see governor-recommended requests at this higher level for two other state-provided services in other committees, one request for the Department of Corrections and the other for the State Patrol at the Department of Public Safety.
Commissioner, is there some reason that we're forecasting a larger increase for this group than the regular state employees?
Mr. Chair, the general thinking for the higher increase for both our direct care staff at our high security facilities as well as correction staff and public safety is the nature of those activities. Specialized direct care services in unusual settings, our settings being forensic settings.
So that, Madam Commissioner, is there a competitive marketplace problem that people in these kinds of fields are more competitive and therefore you have to pay more to get them to fill those slots?
Mr. Chair, there is specialized training that is required. There are specialized settings and require special types of people to work in those kinds of settings. It also is a cost to operate those kinds of facilities, to do direct care management in a secure setting rather than an open setting.
Thank you.
That completes my walkthrough of both financial operations and the two budget pages that fall in my area. So if there aren't further questions, Commissioner Wilson can walk you through the other three areas.
Questions? thank you, Commissioner, for your testimony. Now we'll have Assistant Commissioner Wilson. Who also received a little training in this committee.
A lot of training in this committee, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Tim Wilkin, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. And I'll be walking you through the next several budget pages, starting with page 19. This area is our legal and regulatory compliance. Their job is to provide legal standards by which the agency must operate and by which clients receive human services. It also includes our appeals and regulatory service areas. That area provides fair hearings for clients who have been denied, reduced, or had benefits denied or reduced or terminated. Also resolves appeals from clients that were denied licenses or whose licenses were suspended or revoked. They also review about 2,000 agency contracts per year. Also included in this area is licensing. Many of you will be familiar with this area over the years as you have constituents that are affected by licensing issues. Licensing includes child care centers, child foster care, group homes, adult foster care, residential chemical dependency treatment, day training and habilitation services, and the like. This area also conducts background studies, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a little bit. Last year, they conducted 225,000 background studies on individuals who were working with children and vulnerable adults. And excuse me, they also perform investigations of maltreatment of the children and vulnerable adults. Also in this area is the internal audit area, and they audit the agency's fiscal management and controls. This includes internal controls, conducting management-requested operational reviews, auditing counties, grantees, and vendors.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner Wilkin. On page 20, there's a notation of investigations of alleged maltreatment, and I was kind of struck by the 4,000 reports, 794 are determined to need field investigation, which, you know, is less than a fourth. And could you tell us a little bit more about, are these alleged maltreatment in state-operated facilities, or I'm not familiar with what the ones are that the state would handle here, and why? And is the follow-up more than just determining that a fourth of them are worthy of field investigation, but do you assess the other 3,000 to figure out where training or other sorts of interventions are needed?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, those are for all the programs that the department licenses. So those ones that I kind of enumerated earlier, like the child care centers, child foster care, group homes, and the like, the drop-off would come from as the investigation proceeds, whether it needs to be escalated to a full investigation and the like, or to get all the way to a disciplinary. You're going to have a weed out of things where there really isn't substance to the complaint, and that's all going to vary. And we can provide you more information on that if you'd like. Jerry Kerber, our manager for the director for the licensing area, is here if you have specific questions, but that doesn't answer your question.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
thank you. I would actually like to understand a little bit more, and you can follow up. You don't need to do it at this hearing necessarily, but I'd like to know a little bit more about how we follow up on those 3,000, because obviously for someone to take the energy to file a complaint, there's something that they're concerned about, and whether it's we don't educate the public enough as consumers about what to expect, or we're not training. Our training programs for people who are operating these kinds of facilities are inadequate for them to effectively, you know, deal with things. I'm interested.
Mr. Chairman, it's up to you if you'd like further elaboration or if you'd like me to proceed.
A little bit further, and then I have a question, too.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the Director of the Licensing Division at DHS. And Representative Loeffler, the big number there, the 4,000-some, is related to the number of times somebody contacts us with an issue of any kind. Some of those are not going to be actually alleged neglect or sexual abuse or physical abuse. Sometimes it's a little problem-solving conversation we have with the people. Some callers are calling us with, and they have the wrong agency, for instance, and we need to refer them. Maybe it's a health department issue. Maybe they got a hold of our office, and it's really a nursing home issue that they have. But every single one of those contacts gets resolved. Everything is investigated to some level. And so it isn't that we don't pay any attention to them. There is closure to the issue. Some of them will get a licensing investigation. It's really not an alleged maltreatment issue, but it might be a violation of a licensing standard. For instance, if somebody calls and says that they don't think their child care center has qualified staff, or they don't think there are enough staff, or there seem to be too many kids in the room. Those things aren't going to necessarily be maltreatment issues, but they're going to be a licensing complaint. And so we follow up on those in the licensing area. So every one of those gets some kind of follow-up.
Thank you.
Mr. Kerber, could you explain the kinds of group homes that you license versus nursing homes that I think are under the Department of Health? And do you investigate complaints at nursing homes, or does the Department of Health do that?
Mr. Chair, we investigate alleged maltreatment in the facilities we license. Nursing homes are licensed by the Department of Health, so the Office of Health Facility Complaints follows up on those reports. Yeah, the Department of Human Services license programs include chemical dependency treatment programs, mental health treatment programs, virtually any of the services for people with developmental disabilities that are licensed. And that would, in some cases, include what people refer to as smaller group homes. They're adult foster care settings where the people may be getting some additional waiver-funded services in addition to the foster care. We do the follow-up in those programs. Child care centers, residential treatment programs for kids, adult daycare programs. I think that's pretty much the list. There are a few others in there. But that's distinguished from the health department that has housing with services or assisted living programs and home care agencies and nursing homes, of course, the more common.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kerber. We greatly expanded, not greatly expanded, but expanded with the licensing bill the kinds of folks that need to have background studies, not just direct care folks with vulnerable adults and kids, but also people who work around the facilities and that kind of thing. And there was some concern that it might be difficult to fill those jobs or put undue burden on these facilities. There was a little bit of discussion about that. Could you just talk about how that's going, and are the background studies working? Or are they too restrictive, not restrictive enough? Do we need to look at that again?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I think the expansion that you're probably referring to is when, I might not be accurate on this, but I think it's referring to when in nursing homes in particular, there was an expansion of the responsibility to do background studies on not just the people who provided direct contact services, which is defined as face-to-face care of some sort, but also all employees of the nursing home. And I think that happened probably about 3 years ago or so, 4 years ago maybe. To our understanding, that's sort of been accepted within the industry. I think one of the things that we were hearing at the time was from the industry was that it was complicated in some cases, in some settings, to figure out who was supposed to have a background study and who wasn't. And so actually by changing that expectation, it made it easier for providers to figure it out, because now it's everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Kerber. Commissioner, welcome.
Yeah, there's two other areas within the legal and regulatory that I want to comment on. One is the Federal Healthcare Program Audits and Evaluation section. The section performs federal and state mandated audits of medical assistance in Minnesota care to confirm proper recipient eligibility. The next is payment error rate measurement section, and they perform federally mandated MA and SCHIP claims, determinations of medical necessity, recipient eligibility, and determination of payment error rates. And that that is that area. In the next few pages, you'll find specific budget sections for those, followed by on page 24 is our first change page that I'd like to discuss. And this is background fee findings. The governor recommends that we apply the $20 background fee to include temporary employment agencies, education programs, and professional services agencies. This is and basically takes the fee that's currently applicable to personal care provider organizations and supplemental nursing services agencies. Basically, what we're doing here is collecting additional money to cover the shortfall that we're having because we've had a 40% increase in the number of background studies in the last year or so. We went from 05 having 160,000 studies to 06 having 225,000 studies. So it's put a burden on the system in being able to perform these in a timely manner. And once we have the additional resources, we'll be able to perform these background checks and statutory timelines. These are to protect children and vulnerable adults. The second change page is on page 26. And this is also dealing with background studies, but this is a little different. This is the governor is recommending an increased appropriation in this area to cover child foster care providers that are covered by the federal Adam Walsh Child Protection Act that was passed last year at by the federal government. This is a more expansive background check. What we're doing here is we're taking this burden off the counties, because the background check is an enhanced background check. It goes much more thoroughly and deep, and all the counties aren't equipped to perform this. For instance, there will be a required FBI fingerprint background-based record check that was previously only done when there was after a BCA check and they found problems. Then they go deeper and do the FBI check. This is going to have to be done on all background checks for child foster care providers. Also, they're going to have to review substantiated child maltreatment findings for all 87 counties rather than the county that's doing the search. As I said, this will transfer all this responsibility to the state. We anticipate about 20,000 additional background checks per year. The funds will be used to buy technology and hire staff to perform these. The technology is initially what we're going to do is we're going to take the fingerprint cards and scan them to do the FBI check. As we get the technology in place, we'll have a scanner that will scan your actual hand and take a more accurate scan of your fingerprint to be sent to the FBI to do the check. That's it for the change pages. On page 28, you'll see our description of our management operations, and this is kind of the kind of functions that you'll find in any organization. The house has them. Most businesses have them if they're a substantial size. This is the human resources, communications, equal opportunity, and affirmative action. Probably the unique part that we have in this area is the legislative coordination. This is our people who interact with your committee and make sure that we're here on time and take care of all your requests and needs. If you turn to page 31, we'll see our technology operations. This is a combination of what you consider your traditional IT and your physical facilities. They manage the central office, which is three main offices and three smaller offices, the actual physical plant of it. But the IT section basically handles all the infrastructure that support the systems that are developed to handle the health care and the child care, the child support enforcement, all the software systems. They handle those infrastructure needs, also email, desktop support, these type of things. They also have a fairly robust capability in telehealth and being able to support patients remotely with physicians. And they have to do it in a fairly sensitive way because they have to be HIPAA compliant to handle all the health records and the medical needs that go along with that. And a lot of other agencies will look to our agency to provide expertise in the teleconferencing capabilities.
And Commissioner, is Health Match in this group, or is this going to come up someplace else?
That's my favorite subject, is Health Match. I actually don't have that in this area. That is one of the program areas that will be in the healthcare area that Mr. Osberg handles. But we're all kind of involved in Health Match and trying to move the project along. But this will provide the mainframes, the actual hardware technology that everything will work on. So that's all I have, Mr. Chairman. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions for Commissioner Wilkin? Representative Abler.
Not to just be too tough on the commissioner here, but will there be a health match update sometime? I don't want to be unkind to my friend. But is that going to come up later as one of our reviews?
Well, Mr. Abler, I think that I don't know if it will come up with Mr. Osberg later today, but certainly there's enough there that we could spend an hour on that topic alone.
An hour would be merciful, Mr. Chairman.
Any Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Assistant Commissioner Wilkin. Is this the area that would handle Maxis and that computer system?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, those are in the specific areas, so the assistant commissioners that handle those areas will be able to best handle your questions with regard to the actual systems.
Okay. Well, as this is the office that seems to kind of be looking at for the overall structure, I'd say you've got your work cut out for you. I hope you're up to it.
We're working hard, spent a lot of time on IT.
Any more questions for Commissioner Wilkin? Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner, for testifying for our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I will have Commissioner Osberg to continue with the health care programs. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brian Osberg. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare for the Department of Human Services. And our budget pages begin on page 108. What I'm going to do is describe our healthcare programs and how we administer those, and then get into the change pages as they come along. We have three major healthcare programs in Minnesota. One is the medical assistance program, which otherwise is called Medicaid, the federal Medicaid program. The second is Minnesota Care, and the third is general assistance medical care. We should have a fourth one, the prescription drug program, but that went away after the Medicare Part D program was enacted. And we currently serve about 660,000 Minnesotans, low-income families with children, pregnant women, elderly and people with disabilities, including those in nursing homes. Now, my budget area is called basic health care services, as opposed to the long-term care or home and community-based services. So when I talk about basic health care services, I'm referring to hospitalization, physician services, dental services, pharmacy services, those kind of services. So I'm not discussing here long-term care services or home and community-based services. That's under Assistant Commissioner Coleman's area. Now, our programs are financed through state and federal dollars primarily. We have a 50-50 match with the federal government. That's the lowest any state can get. Some states down south have a 70-some percent match from the federal government. It's a function of the state's economy, by and large. So we get 50%. We've always had 50%, so I don't see that changing anytime soon, unfortunately. But in Minnesota Care, it's a combination of things. We finance it through what's called the Healthcare Access Fund. And the Healthcare Access Fund, I'll get into a minute as to what's all in that, but it also includes the State Children's Health Insurance Program. That was a program that was enacted by the federal government 10 years ago to get more insurance coverage for children in this country, and it's worked in a lot of ways. Now, we enacted a program for children before that. So our SCHIP money does not go towards kids. It goes towards parents in the Minnesota Care program. As I said before, a good deed goes unpunished. And so, in fact, now they're debating in Congress whether or not they're going to allow states to use SCHIP money for parents going forward. So we're very concerned about that discussion, and hopefully that will not take place. But again, the reason we do that is because we already had coverage for kids. And when you deal with the federal government, there's something called maintenance of effort. You can hear that time and time again. Maintenance of effort. Boy, there's a county maintenance of effort in some cases, and a state maintenance of effort. Well, we have to maintain an effort when we do business with the federal government. So you'll hear more about that. Now, about 70% of our clients are enrolled in managed care arrangements. We have 9 managed care contracts. 3 of them are county-based purchasing arrangements, whereby the counties have actually got into the business of being a health plan. And the 4th plan is Metropolitan Health Plan, which is a creature of or subsidiary of Hennepin County. So 4 of the 9 managed care organizations that we deal business with are really sponsored in some fashion by a county or counties. Now, under law, these people, and it's not easily distinguished, but simply put, families with children, adults without kids, and the elderly are required to enroll in managed care. And those health plans, HMOs, that do business in the state, which are all nonprofit HMOs, are required to participate and serve our clients. Now, our other clients are enrolled in what we call fee-for-service arrangement. Those are people with disabilities. So that's how... Now, I'll talk a little bit in a second here about the fact that there's some options available to people with disabilities, but by and large, that's the distinction you need to make. Now, we also have 2 demonstration projects that we're very proud of, frankly. One is called Minnesota Senior Health Options. That's where we serve 35,000 of our elderly clients who are dually eligible. They're both on Medicare and Medicaid. We have 100,000 of our clients of the 660,000 who are on both Medicare and Medicaid. You're going to hear them referred to as dually eligible or dual eligibles. And whereby we're trying to coordinate with Medicare in some fashion. In fact, we've led the country in the ability to do that. And so we've enrolled 35,000 now of our clients into something called Minnesota Senior Health Options, where you integrate long-term care services with health care services, and you co-mingle Medicare and Medicaid monies into one program. And that way you have a single entity, and often these people have a single individual who coordinates all of their care, all of their long-term care and medical care. And as I said, there's you don't have to send a bill off to Medicare and a separate bill to Medicaid. One organization, in this case a managed care organization, all 9 managed care organizations that we do business with are actually MSHO arrangements, or actually got into this business. Because Medicare provided that incentive a couple of years ago when they established something called special needs plan. And so it's really a very beneficial program for our seniors. We have another program called Minnesota Disability Health Options, MINDO. And this is a voluntary program for people with physical disabilities. And it's a program that's sponsored by UCARE, and they contract with a joint venture between Courage Center and Sister Kinney called Access to provide care coordination to this population. About 750 clients are enrolled in that program today. And it's just in the metropolitan area. Again, it's a voluntary option for people with disabilities because, as I said, people with disabilities are not required to enroll in managed care. Others are. We also have a small pilot for those who are developmentally disabled. It's in 3 counties, Scott, Carver, and Hennepin County, and it's a program that, again, UCARE is helping us administer. And right now, it's limited to 120 individuals. We only have 30-some enrolled now. It just started recently. Whereby people who are developmentally disabled will have their waiver services, their DD waiver services, and their health care services coordinated through one organization. We're going to see how well that works. And we recently submitted a report to the legislature about where we should go with all this down the road, these fully integrated models. And we can go over that report someday when you'd like us to. But we're suggesting that we wait a couple of years before we expand those fully integrated models, where we take the waiver services and healthcare services and integrate them all in one organization. And we have some other things we need to do first, and we also want to see how these current programs proceed. Now, if you look at page 109, you get a sense of the magnitude of dollars we're talking about. And that is, we have about $9 billion, $9 billion of federal and state money goes towards our programs. Now, let me now turn to page 111, which is the Minnesota CARE budget page. Now, you've heard a lot about Minnesota CARE, I know, through your committee discussions. So let me quickly go through this. We had it at one point. We had over 150,000 people enrolled in Minnesota CARE. Now it's roughly $120,000. Some changes that I'll go through in a minute here in 2003 affected that, but also other things that are affecting enrollment in Minnesota Care. And Minnesota Care was also an opportunity to disconnect eligibility from our categorical problems from MFIP, for example. The program you just heard about, TANF and MFIP, is, you know, are the same thing. Disconnect our categorical eligibility from healthcare eligibility, allowing people to maintain eligibility for healthcare even though they're not eligible for our welfare program. That happened some time ago, and that was important development back in the 90s. Because at one point, you only had healthcare coverage if you were in one of our categories, as they call it, categorically needy. And that's no longer the case. We now allow for a eligibility, and as you'll see in a second, we have eligibility criteria that's much different than we do for our MFIP program, for example. Now, this program, Minnesota Care, is financed through, as I said, the Healthcare Access Fund. That's financed through a couple of means. One is a 2% provider tax. Another is a 1% premium tax against insured businesses in this state, against insurance companies. This also includes federal money, both Medicaid money and SCHIP money. It also includes premiums that are paid. Everybody enrolled in Minnesota Care pays a premium. And either it's from $4 at the lowest end per month for a child to up as high as $400-some a month for a family of four. If you look at A12, back in the green section of your document, you get an idea as to eligibility, who's eligible for Minnesota Care. In fact, this graph tries to capture eligibility for all of our programs. A12, back in the green section, I'm going to reference this a few times, so and also reference A11, which lays out the federal poverty guideline numbers. But in A12, you can see for families and children, Minnesota Care coverage is up to 275% of the federal poverty guideline. As I said, the page before in A11, or A10, I'm sorry, you get an idea as to what the federal poverty guideline is. You should have the most updated one, at least the one that's going to be revised beginning in July. And it depends on family size. And federal poverty guideline numbers is determinant of family size. So you see that Minnesota Care, children and parents up to 275% are covered. Now, in the proposal that I went over last week, the governor's proposal would increase this to 300% for kids. But right now, under Minnesota Care, it's 275% for children and for parents. Now, for adults without children, if you look in the middle of the graph, you can see that for adults without children, it's up to 175% of the federal poverty guideline. And I'll go over the difference in terms of benefits provided for that population as opposed to others. And so you get an idea as to who's covered under Minnesota Care. Again, about half of the enrollees are children, just like half of our enrollees for all of our programs are children. So let me give you a little history about this. I already mentioned the fact that Minnesota Care was established back in the early 90s. Back in the late 80s, we developed something called Children's Health Plan first. Then in the 90s, we started covering adults who are parents and also adults without children, as I said, built up to 275% of poverty. Now, Minnesota Care waiver, we have to get federal approval for these kind of programs in order to get the federal money. We go through that every 3 years or so. That waiver is going to come up in 08, whereby we're going to ask for federal financial participation. So every 3 years or so is when we go back to the federal government and ask for what we call the expansion population, because Medicaid pays for it. Even though Medicaid standards are less than 275%, Medicaid money is used to pay for this service. And so when you hear about the term expansion population, well, Minnesota Care is an expansion population beyond what we typically think about medical assistance, which I'll talk about next. And as I said, changes took place in 2003. A number of changes did. One is that the parents earning more than $50,000 lost coverage And those above 275% of poverty lost continuation coverage. At one point, if you exceeded the poverty guideline, you actually had some coverage for a period of time. Not unlike if you left your employer and you have this COBRA arrangement. Well, something like that we had in Minnesota Care at one point. Well, for a period of time, you maintain coverage even though you exceeded your income standard. We no longer have that in place. We also, in 2003, established assets for the first time, asset standard for Minnesota Care. Before that, there was not an asset standard. And it's $10,000 for a person and $20,000 for two people. And so that for the first time, we did that. We also, in 2003, established a six-month renewal process, eligibility determination process. Before that, was 12 months. It was 6 months for medical assistance and GAMC, so now it's 6 months for all the programs. And we also changed in 2003 that what's called the auto newborn coverage, whereby kids, newborns, were covered automatically for 2 years in medical assistance and in Minnesota Care. Now it's 1 year. And then after that 1 year, they need to, of course, seek a renewal and determine whether their eligibility is still intact. Now, on page 115, you'll see the money that goes into Minnesota Care program. Again, this is all in the Healthcare Access Fund primarily, and you have a Healthcare Access Fund forecast in your budget page. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Brutt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Osborne, do you have information that you can provide me that shows, you said something about the folks over $50,000 and your term was lost coverage. My question is, how many of them have coverage now in some manner versus how many remain uninsured?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, we can get that information for you, I think. We can at least tell you how many people were affected by the change and how many people we projected would be affected by the change. We can't tell you today whether or not they have coverage. We would not be able to track that down. And I know that the health department has done some studies in the past about the uninsured, but I don't think they've ever tracked specifically anybody that may have otherwise been eligible for Minnesota Care. But we can tell you how many people were affected by the change in terms of who were currently covered at the time, and how many people we thought that we projected would be affected by the change over time. We'll get that information to
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner Osberg, I think that would be helpful for me. You know, I read in the newspapers back in 2003, and I don't have perfect recollection, but the estimations that were given were quite dramatic. And it's my understanding that the actuality is much different. So I certainly would appreciate both the projections that you made, the projections that were made. Maybe I can go back and find out the projections by others, but I want to know where we sit today.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, by and large, there's about 36,000 people that would have been affected by the changes. About 12,000 of them were actually enrolled at the time and lost coverage. Another 24,000 would have otherwise been eligible, based on our projections, over the next 4 years after 2003. Now, it's true that that enrollment has gone down a little bit more than 36,000 in terms of projection, but we went back and looked at those changes, and we think that the projection that we had was pretty accurate. Now, there's other reasons that people have lost coverage or decided not to maintain their coverage. And we think one of the major reasons is the cost of the premiums, as disposable income becomes a challenge for families because your premium is subject to your income, and your income, premium is scaled based on your income up to about 9.8% of income. And we think that one of the issues that people are facing is that with higher gas prices and mortgage rates, that people in the higher income bracket for Minnesota Care are having a hard time paying that premium level. So we think that that there's not necessarily a disconnect between what we projected because of the program changes and what actually happened. We think actually that was pretty accurate projection. Does that help?
Representative Pearson.
Just a question on the chart. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the parents under Minnesota Care, there's kind of multicolors in that column.
Yes.
Can you just explain? explain why, can you just explain that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, 200% of for parents are financed through the SCHIP money. That's why we make the distinction.
100 to 200 is.
100 to 200% of FPG for parents are financed through the SCHIP program, where we get 65% federal money. We get about $46 million this fiscal year from SCHIP, and so it's an important contribution. That's why we made it a different color.
Okay, thank you.
Right.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. My question is in relation to the A15 chart that talks about our current programs. And I'm curious if you could provide us with a similar type of graph that perhaps addresses our region that we're in, maybe the 10-state region we're in, to kind of give an idea that includes the what they cover for some of these programs in relation to the federal poverty guidelines. Is that information readily available?
Yeah,
so we can kind of get an understanding of what we do in comparison to our neighboring states.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Yes, we can do that. We can provide information as to what, especially Wisconsin and our neighboring states,
I think that
provide.
Helpful.
Yes, we can do that. Then I would turn you to page 122. And this is our, what we call the Medical Assistance Basic Health Care Grant Program for Families and Children. And whereby we provide medical assistance coverage for about 336,000 families with children. And in medical assistance, your eligibility is 3 months retroactive. And that's not true in general assistance medical care or in Minnesota care. Now, this the eligibility for this program is administered by counties. And eligibility is, of course, set by state and federal guidelines. We also have, under this category, the new Minnesota Family Planning Program. It started back in July 2006, and I believe you've had bills associated with that program in front of your committee. And whereby we received a federal waiver for covering people up to 200% of the federal poverty guideline. And we also have, if you go back again to A12, back in your graph in the green section, you can see that we cover pregnant women up to 275% of poverty, infants up to 280% of poverty. And the reason that is that in order to secure the SCHIP money, we have to have a differential between what we cover for kids, regular kids, and we cover for infants. We have to have a 5% differential. So we have coverage up to 275% of the federal poverty guideline for children, so we have to have another 5% on top of that for infants. And that's why you saw in the governor's proposal last week the differential between the 300% proposal and the 305 for infants. Now, kids 8, 19, and 20 are 100% of poverty, not 150%. Children between 2 and 18 are 150%, but children 19 and 20 are 100% of poverty. And the asset limits are the same as Minnesota care, $10,000 for an individual, $20,000 for two or more. Again, on page 122, you'll see... Yes.
The assets, would that include any 401s that they had?
Assets do not include a burial fund, a homestead, or a car, but includes everything else.
So, okay.
So, yes, it would include a 401k program. Yes, that's what you...
Yeah.
So on page 122, you can see there's one correction on page 122. It is the co-payment for pharmacy is a $12 monthly max, not $20. It used to be $20, and that changed last year or the year before. I don't recall right now. So there's a $12 a month max in terms of out-of-pocket payment for your pharmacy co-pay. Otherwise, you can see the co-pays that we have on those pages for non-preventive visits and for pharmacy services. Those co-payments went into effect 2003 as well.
Representative Tao.
Thank you. Commissioner Osberg, what's the compliance rate? You know, how many people are actually doing the co-pays and are
costing now. I know that they don't have to pay if they say they don't.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tao, that's a good question. Right now, what you just said is correct, and that is they're not required to pay if they can demonstrate that they cannot pay, and that the provider has to accept that the demonstration, if you will, and so we don't know how many clients actually do pay the copayment, how many do not. As you just heard earlier, how this works is that the provider collects the copay, and we take that amount off the amount we pay the provider. So we pay them, the provider, less no matter what, whether or not they got the copayment or not. So we really don't know how many people are actually paying the copay and how many are not at this point. I don't know if we can calculate that. I'm getting no's from the audience, my staff, so probably not.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much is that copay worth to us as a state? How much do we save on
it? It's, Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I want to say it's about $11 million a year.
Marie?
$11 million a year for medical assistance. And that's state and federal? State only.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. My follow-up is question is to Representative Howe's question, and that is that, and you said that you don't know how many clients pay. So, I'm curious, what type of verification process do you have if we're not sure, and if we don't have one, why don't we?
Commissioner.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Again, what we've done is made it the provider's business, and that's why we don't need to verify it. In the original legislation, there was the ability for provider not to provide service if there was non-collected debt. However, that was litigated, and that law was overturned about 2 years ago. Now, the federal law allows us an option to implement co-payments and to require providers or allow providers to not provide a service if it's not collected debt. However, it's a much more complicated option beyond that we opted not to propose to the legislature. But the federal law does allow, under certain circumstances, ability for providers to now not provide a service if there's a non-collected debt because of lack of co-payment. But at this point, we do not... It is the provider's arrangement with the client.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just following up with Representative Pepin, so there's no mechanism for truly understanding if there's some type of trend out there with some providers who are requesting the co-payment versus just saying, well, the state's going to pay me X amount of dollars anyway, so why bother? If I'm understanding you correctly, there's no real mechanism for us either to understand a trend or to respond to any provider who just doesn't want to go that direction.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, again, I want to clarify something you just said, that we do reduce that co-payment from the provider's payment, so it is in their interest to collect it, number one. Number two is that we have talked to the health department in the past about doing a survey, doing some study of some sort to determine what the impact has been on the COVID. They've not been able to secure the kind of grant money to do something like that. But that's what it would take. They'd do an actual study, a very scientific study, to find out what has been the impact of this co-payment being in place. Now, you can get some anecdotal information from the providers, as we do, as to what happens. So we have anecdotal information as to, you know, how frequently they collect the co-payment and things of that sort. But it is just anecdotal, and you could perhaps ask the provider associations for some idea of that. But again, we have not done any kind of scientific measurement of that.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then maybe I'm misunderstanding, Mr. Osberg, Commissioner Osberg, what you're saying. So just help me walk through this. I'm sorry. So a provider issues a prescription, and you then, or the state then, reimburses that provider less some type of copay for that prescription. So then what happens to the provider once that person has reached that maximum? Do they then eat the amount of money for the co-pays from there forward? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, no, the maximum is the maximum out-of-pocket for the enrollee. So the enrollee is no longer obligated to pay beyond $12 a month. So there is no, then the provider gets paid the full amount from us.
Representative Bunn.
Chair and Commissioner, again, to follow up on this line of questioning, this is the lowest incomes Minnesotans that are involved in these programs. I would expect a very large number of them to attest that they can't afford the copay when they show up at a provider's office, given their budget constraints. And you're saying that it's up to the provider to collect that, and moreover, it's for the provider to determine whether they have the ability to pay or not. So first of all, do I understand that correctly? And secondly, are you also saying that the mechanism by which a provider might try to determine their ability to pay is completely up to the provider? It's a transaction cost, that burden that falls on them, and that what mechanism that is could vary across every provider.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, no, it's not up to the provider to determine their ability to pay. They have to accept the statement from the individual that I cannot afford it. They have to accept that as fact. And so they don't have to determine in any way whether or not the person can afford it.
Well, back to my first statement, that I wouldn't expect to collect hardly any of this. So, in fact, this whole movement towards co-pays is probably kind of a moot point, and we're really just talking about the state providing a certain amount of these services. But so I'd be interested, like for any of the others here, to see how much of this is ever collected and what the problems are with this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, I agree that it would be worth examining further as to what is actually happening out there. We have not done that. We've not had the resources to do that. I think it's worth talking about how can we go about determining what actual impact is. And maybe what we could do is have some discussions with the providers and give you an idea as to what we're hearing. But I think you're right. It's worth examining.
Representative Bunn.
Just one follow-up comment. I'm not saying whether we should have the copay or not. Maybe with the levels of income involved here, copays just don't make sense in the end. But it just seems to put the providers through this kind of process that appears to be a little bit of a charade, and just creates additional effort for them to engage in that might be something we should look into whether it's effective at all.
Representative Bunn, I was just looking at my calendar here for the day, and I see I'm meeting with the Minnesota Pharmacists Association at 2:30, so if you'd like to come up to my office, so you can ask those questions. Who is next here? Representative Wampler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While we're talking about this, I think we really have to talk about how it's much more than the providers who have things at risk here, and it's more than dollars. I was told of an individual who, because of fiscal constraints, decided to forgo blood pressure medications because they couldn't pay the copay. And that person woke up with a horrible headache. 911 was called. They got hauled into the emergency room, stroked out, did the best that they could. The person didn't survive. This is someone in their 40s. If that person had survived with a traumatic brain injury, it would have cost us easily more than that $1 million that this whole budget discussion is all about. And so, I mean, there's the cost shifting and then the lack of reimbursement to the providers, but there's also, if people don't get critically needed care via prescriptions or other things, there's sometimes consequences beyond them themselves and their personal choices to the rest of us in other pages in this budget. And I think we need to weigh those things as we make these choices. And if we're going to analyze things, I would like to suggest that we also do some surveying of emergency rooms in areas with high Medicaid populations to get some feedback on those kinds of experiences.
Commissioner.
My first change budget proposal, the governor's proposal, is on page 126. This proposal would increase medical mileage reimbursement to clients in our program, or neighbors or friends of our clients. We pay for transportation for medical services. Right now we pay 20 cents per mile. That's been in statute for some time, for 10, 11 years. And what we want to do is set this rate to 15 cents less than the IRS business rate, which is 48.5 cents. So this would increase the mileage reimbursement up to 33.5 cents per mile. And again, we want to encourage this mode of transportation, especially since if otherwise they may want to secure a more expensive mode like the taxi. So so we're suggesting at this point that we increase the reimbursement to 33.5 cents and tag it, more importantly, to the business IRS business rate, so it will go up automatically when that rate goes up. And this is about $1.4 million of new money, general fund money, for next biennium for this proposal. The next category is Minnesota Medical Assistance Basic Health Care Grants for Elderly and Disabled on page 127. We purchased health care for about 53,000 elderly and 94,000 people with disabilities. As I mentioned, elderly are enrolled by and large in managed care, and people with disabilities are in our fee-for-service program. We also provide for assistance to pay for Medicare premiums and co-payments for low-income Medicare people. These people are not on our programs, not on medical assistance, but they're low-income Medicare people. And so we help them with a Medicare Part B premium, and some of the co-payments they have with and cost sharing they have with Medicare program. And it's pegged to the, again, to the federal poverty guidelines amount. So we're involved in this program as well. Again, this is administered by.
Go ahead, finish.
This is administered. This eligibility determination, which includes a long-term care. Eligibility for nursing home is administered through county services.
Commissioner, if some elderly person's in a nursing home, they're on medical assistance to pay for their nursing home costs, and they and presumably they're also on Medicare, and they're having visits by a physician to the nursing home, is that considered part of the nursing home cost, or is that separate from what the nursing home is being reimbursed?
Mr. Chairman, that is separate. That would be covered under Medicare, under whether Medicare. They're both on Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare pays first before Medicaid pays. And so Medicare, as you know, covers.
That would be Part B in this case.
Part B, right. So the physician would be reimbursed not through the rate paid to the nursing home, but be reimbursed separately through the Medicare program. Now, again, back in A12 and back in the green section, you can see where people, where elderly or people with disabilities, the federal poverty guideline standard for eligibility is 100% of the poverty level. And we also have something called medical spend down, whereby if your income is higher than 100%, you still may be eligible for medical assistance if you spend down the difference between your income and 75% of the federal poverty guideline mark. So if you spend that down, and we calculate this, we help people calculate this going forward every 6 months. And say, okay, we anticipate that you're going to spend down to this. That way, the income could be higher than 100% of FPG, and then they don't lose the rest of their income, so they're protected. That 75% of their income is protected. So it's called the medical spend down program. It's very complicated, but it's also a very nice feature of our program. So people who can maintain their income status while being eligible for medical assistance.
But again, Mr. Commissioner, if they did have a 401k, they'd have to spend that basically all down.
Mr. Chairman, right, again,
not on a monthly basis, but spend it all down.
Right. The asset limits for people who are elderly and people with disabilities are different. It's $3,000 for one person and $6,000 for two people, as opposed to $10,000 and $20,000 for Minnesota Care. And for parents, and so what's excluded from those assets again is burial fund, homestead, and car. And I believe I have everything. Like, But like anything other investments, be it life insurance or 401k or savings accounts or anything else, would be counted towards your asset limit.
Now, let me go back again. This is a little out of where you are, but somebody on family on Minnesota Care, what's the asset limit?
Mr. Chairman, the asset limit is $10,000 for an individual and $20,000 for two.
Okay, so that they had $21,000 in a 401k, they would not be eligible.
Mr. Chairman, that is that would be correct.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you were asking those questions. I'm trying to refresh my memory here. With the life insurance, how did we end up not excluding life insurance when we decided to make this policy? What is the history behind including the life insurance? So we're basically making sure that if our parents have, you know, $11,000 to make sure that we can bury them, that they wouldn't be eligible, but then we say we want them to have life insurance so that we're not causing hardship on the families around burial. So what is the history with the life insurance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, I really don't know, other than the fact that assets could take many forms. Life insurance is just one form. It could take, you know, you have other arrangements. That did. So it's a question of a policy as to what who should be eligible for our programs. And so it's been determined over the years. It's been at $3,000 and $6,000 for some time, I believe. And so it's just a matter of legislative policy, and I don't know whether or not there's any, maybe Ms. Henry can help me here, whether or not there's any federal direction on this issue.
Would you identify yourself for the tape, please?
Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Henry from the Department of Human Services, and I'm the Director of Healthcare Eligibility and Access Division. The exclusion for life insurance is part of our burial exclusion policy. So essentially, you can protect a significant amount of money through a prepaid burial plan, and that combined with life insurance policies is an extremely complicated policy, but it is possible to set aside funding for burial if that was the purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does burial include the casket, or does that just include the plot?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, it's what do they call them? Burial space items, which includes the casket art.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, you said this is complicated. I'm not an intelligent individual, and I'm pretty sure that I have difficulties trying to figure this out, helping a constituent or my mother or something like that. And so what's the maximum for the burial exclusion before I ask my second question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, the maximum with many exceptions to the burial exclusion is $1,500.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Now, while I disagree with the long-standing legislative policy around the pensions and 401k, I can put that on the table and say I'll hold my arguments. But, members, that's something we have to look at. You can't even get a cremation for $1,500 anymore. Even if you have a plot that your parents have paid for, you can't buy a casket for $1,500 anymore. And to be excluding individuals out of a program at their most need, because we don't want them to make sure that they have expenses allowed to cause less hardship on children and grandchildren. I don't know about you guys. It is the worst thing to take a collection for family members who did not plan their burial. That is the worst thing. And then the one household who may seem to have more money than the other household and the hardship having to come on them, and then if you don't put up and the fights that happen after and a loved one has gone and you're responsible for burying them, I think, Mr. Chair, this is something that we really need to discuss and figure out what we're going to do, at least for the life insurance policy. If we're talking about wanting to get more individuals to take out long-term care policies, and making sure that they have opportunities to take care of themselves in their longer years of life, what are we doing in causing hardship on these families at the end of the life when life insurance is necessary?
Ms. Henry.
Mr. Chair and members, when I say that there's many exceptions, it's very common for a medical assistance applicant who's preparing to apply for medical assistance to set aside any amount of money they choose for burial expenses. People that don't pre-plan are the ones that are most likely to get caught up in only having a $1,500 limit. Otherwise, because we don't count any of the burial space items, and we also don't count irrevocable burial trusts, by setting burials up in those vehicles, people can plan and have a sufficient amount of money to cover their burials.
Well, Representative Walker, as someone who's been browbeating his two semi-adult children to make sure they put their money in their 401ks, if they did that, they wouldn't be eligible for Minnesota Care. Gottwald, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Representative Walker, we're in agreement on this. This is an issue that I came into the legislature with, and I'll turn this into a question, but it's not just the burial expense. I'm in the middle of this right now with my own mother-in-law, and it's extraordinary, the extent to which we require people to spend down their assets at a time when we want them to hang on to it and use it. My colleague here, Representative Tao, was telling me that that's a Democratic position. I said, no, that's a good Republican position too, because you're getting people to hang on to their assets and use them for their own purposes. The burial limit is low, but I keep wondering, has the department explored any possibility? I realize dollars and cents come into this too, and we've got to be realistic, but it seems to me there ought to be some allowance for people, low income granted, on these public health programs to be able to set aside a certain amount of money for other needs in retirement besides trying to sock away as much as they can in a burial plan. And they can really only use those for certain things anyway. But I wonder if we could think a little more outside the box, or if the department has thought about allowing them to have some, not an unlimited 401k, but maybe a certain amount of money that they can keep for retirement purposes in some, qualified account, so that they don't end up having to spend all the way down. Right now, financial planners typically advise people as they get late in their life and look at skilled nursing facility needs, hey, spend down all your money and go on medical assistance. What's the cost to the state of that? Can we have some approaches that allow people to hang on to more of their resources? Any response?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gottwald, have you been...
This will be your final bit.
Okay. Have you been introduced yet to the long-term care partnership program that we've established here? That whereby there's incentives for people to buy long-term care insurance that way that they would be able to protect some of their assets in case of a spend-out situation or a recovery situation after the fact.
Mr. Chair, it's an opportunity for me to put in a plug for a bill I'll be bringing forward on long-term care, incentives for people to purchase long-term care coverage. But I think we really do need to look at the system, and I agree with Representative Walker and others who think this doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, Representative Gottwald, that sounds like a nonpartisan bill. Thank you, Commissioner, for your testimony today. And with that, did we do the meeting adjourned.